Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there. You're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and in each episode, I interview professors, doctors, and research scientists who are leading authorities in technology, economics, business, politics, the environment, and sociology, so we can learn about the scientific breakthroughs that will redefine our world. Today, I'm delighted to share my conversation with Dr. Felix Giller. Dr. Giller is a research scientist at the University of Zurich with expertise in health policy, governance, and public trust in data use within healthcare systems. He's a widely published research scientist in top academic journals and has recently published his first book, What is Public Trust in the Health System? In our conversation, we talk about five main areas. So the first one, we discuss the concept of trust. What is it? And is there a difference between individual trust and public trust? We then go and address the three questions that he talks about in his book. So what is public trust in the health system? Why do we care about it? And how do we foster public trust in the health system? And then finally, we have an eye on the future, where we're talking about how artificial intelligence affects trust and whether or not we can indeed trust an artificial intelligence and what does that even mean in practical sense. It's a fascinating conversation. I think you're going to really enjoy this one. So please now enjoy this conversation with Dr. Felix Giller. Dr. Giller, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, hi. No, nice to meet you. Hi.
So let's talk about trust.
Yes.
Could you explain what you think it is?
Well, trust, I think, is an interesting topic because I think the listeners and we all have a very good personal understanding of what trust is from our daily life, private life. And so I would consider everyone already an expert in what trust is. But I think in research and in our work, we usually define trust as a relational construct where one person trusts another person in anticipation of a beneficial outcome or at least no harm. So I would say the important part of trust is that there are usually at least two different actors involved, and there's a relationship between those actors, and one actor is doing something for another actor.
And how do you build trust? So we talk about two individual levels. So you and I talking today, we've met for the first time. So how over time do you build trust with each other on an individual level?
On an individual level, I think there are different ways to trust building. So for example, for the two of us, I've heard from a colleague that she did an interview with you. She recommended you and talked very highly about you and the experience. So that obviously is already a very positive picture. And then I think also during conversations, during work we do together, we build together, we have positive shared experiences. And over time, I think in those relationships, you start to know each other very well. You know how the other behaves, you know how much you can rely on others. And that's how you usually build trust in day-to-day, daily relationships. So it's really, I think, something on the one hand around, let's call it maybe reputation or what somebody else talks about somebody. But then it's also about the shared positive experiences. I think in the professional environment, sometimes you would also consider science and signals like labels. So for example, when you talk to a healthcare professional, you see blue NHS label, and that's a sign of your reputation. You know, somebody has certain education or a familiar, similar background, and those traits also, I would say, helps trust building. But I think in private life, usually it's very basic. You meet somebody and then you talk to the person, you share experiences, you talk about past experiences, shared experiences. And then I think as an individual, you come, to conclusions about trustworthiness. But that said, sounds already like a very calculated approach, right? So as if we would have a checklist in our head and then we tick boxes and then we say, okay, this is a trustworthy someone. But then we also know that trust is built by emotions, by gut feeling, I would say. So sometimes it's maybe the first firm handshake or the first appearance as well. So as you can hear already, it's quite a complex construct. But there are different, I think, avenues towards trust building.
Now,
in everyday language, trust is used and abused in different levels of importance. So there's trust that someone will turn up if you're planning to meet them for coffee. There's trust that you can give somebody your authority or responsibility to take charge of something. There's trust that you would have in someone to look after your children whilst you're going away for a weekend. These are all different levels of trust. So in the research, is there an articulation of, so yeah, you've got the entry level of how you start to trust somebody in the first place, but then there are scales of trust, and some people, you trust them to do some things and not others. So how has the concept flexed, or how does it flex in the research, if at all, in order to accommodate these different sentiments behind it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you have like basically two different ways how you can approach the question. On the one hand, term often is used situational trust. So you trust somebody, for example, in one situation, but not in the other situation, depending on the competences or anticipated competences, etc. So you don't trust everyone for everything. Let's say it's not like a blanco check, and you know, it's usually very much linked to a certain action or anticipated outcome or etc. And then the other thing is, I think also because you briefly mentioned that nowadays the term is quite frequently used in the public sphere, so in the media, let's say. There's also, I think, a difference between the terms. So you have trust, right? That's what we talk about now, and that's also the focus of my research. But then we also have terms like confidence. We have terms like faith. We have belief. We have hope. Even to a certain extent, love. So there are certain concepts which are used as if they would be synonyms, but I would argue they are not necessarily. But then again, that also depends on where I use the terms. For research, we need conceptual precision, so that's why we try to define what trust is, what maybe self-confidence and confidence is, etc. But maybe for the general daily life, I would say often those words are used interchangeably as if they would be the same word. But for example, just to use the word faith, I would associate faith more with religion, so you have faith in God, whereas trust is something between humans. And so I think the terms are used in different contexts, different ways. But for research, well, my work, I really focus on the term trust only as a relational construct, as I said, between humans initially.
And how do humans lose trust? So you gain it, and that takes time, and then you could seem to lose it pretty quickly. So how do you lose trust?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So I think that's also the importance of trust, the interest of fear, or an interesting part of trust is that really, as you say, it takes sometimes years to build trust, depending on the context. And then it's gone very fast. And usually you lose trust, I would say, when you have negative experiences. That's the classic. When you were betrayed, when you had a negative one, maybe not one experience that was not as you envisioned. And that's usually how you lose trust. That said, I think we see also in research that mistrust can be inherited. So, for example, or the other way around, trust can be inherited. So when you have that's your family and the cultural setting where you're sitting in and friends, and when they talk very positively about something or someone, you're usually as a child or somebody living in this community also more inclined to trust the same thing. There's, for example, research showing that with the insurance companies, usually children have similar insurance companies than parents. That can also be for other reasons than trust. But we see that obviously if somebody like your parents, who usually have a trusted relationship, and if they recommend something, you usually trust or are more inclined to trust this as well. So I think trust can be positively or negatively influenced by your local setting, your parents, family, your living environment. But then also from your day-to-day experiences.
And why is it so hard to gain trust and so easy to lose it?
Now, that's that's a good question. And part of my research, I think on the one hand, if people grew up in a, if they're fortunate and grew up in a stable setting, meaning like stable family relationships, stable society, and they have like positive experiences throughout their childhood, I think usually people are quite inclined to trust. So there's this concept of general trust or spontaneous sociability, meaning that when people grow up in a firm, stable environment, they usually go with a positive attitude and into the life and are willing to trust. And so I think generally here's a good it's easy for people to trust. But I think when they are betrayed and they have a lot of negative experiences, I think they are not willing anymore to give this advancement of trust, and they maybe get suspicious. And I think to overcome this negative attitude towards trust building takes really time, because people have attached emotional feelings to trust. And I think you really need to work with that, and cannot just more from a calculated point of view try to approach trust building, but you also need to go into the emotional space, and that is usually quite difficult.
Okay, let's move to from individual trust to public trust. Is there a difference? You see a lot in the media about public trust, but is that a generalization of lots of people not trusting something? Or is it something else?
Yeah, I think I would argue it's something else. So that's also how I started. So 10 years ago, now maybe 11 or 12 years ago, I started my research on that field. Back then, we saw that the term public trust, the English media, is used as if everybody would know what public trust is. So it was a very natural term to use. But then when we look into research, we saw, well, actually, there's not so much conceptual underpinning of what public trust is. And I argued that public trust is not just the aggregated average of individual trust. It's different. And the main difference is, I think individual trust is really, as I said, a relational construct between an individual and another person or an institution, but it's really about the individual benefit. For example, when you go into surgery, it's really something that concerns you as an individual, maybe obviously the family and friends, because they want to have a positive outcome for you as well, but usually it's a very nuclear individual focused construct. Whereas public trust, I would argue, it's a relational construct between the public and the state. Sounds a bit abstract, absolutely, but we see that, for example, in certain healthcare activities, which have a wider benefit, not just for an individual person, for example, vaccination, organ donation, health data sharing, etc. I think there's usually the trust construct building in the public sphere around those issues where people exchange their experiences, their views, And then trust is formed based on the shared discourse and or perception of trust of the healthcare system and the activity. So I think whereas individual trust, as I said, it's really more on the individual level. Public trust is more on the relationship between the state and society. And as I just used those examples, I think also not every healthcare activity is sensible as a case study for trust or where public trust plays out, because there are certain healthcare activities which are really meant for the public, which have maybe also an altruistic component, whereas other healthcare activities are really focused on individuals. So there usually is where I make the differences.
Okay. So your book, which is titled What is Public Trust in the Health System, your most recent book, let's now apply these ideas into the health system. If we can just walk through the core components of your research that you've published there. I think that then brings it to from a kind of abstract concept to a more concrete kind of discussion. So public trust and the health system, why do we care about it?
I think we as professionals, but also policymakers and politicians, should care about public trust, because public trust is basically two main outcomes. One outcome is legitimacy or acceptance. So It means when healthcare actors and their activities, for example, the national vaccination campaign or health data sharing activity, when they enjoy public trust, it's accepted by the public, and healthcare actors have the legitimacy to also enroll those activities. And the other main effect of public trust is the acceptance in the sense of participation. So meaning that people participate in accepted healthcare activities. So they get vaccinated, they open their electronic health record, they donate data, they donate their organs, etc. So participation and legitimacy are the main effects. And then linked to that, there are much more, I would say, secondary effects. So public trust leads to increased population health, to decreased healthcare system costs, and to increased efficiency. And so there are several other effects, but I think the main two effects, and that's why we should care really, is legitimacy and participation.
So we want the healthcare system to be considered as legitimate. Is that what you mean by that? And we yes. want the public yes, yes, to yes. participate in it mm-hmm. In order yeah. for the wider good of the of people's health and longevity and yeah. things that come with that.
Exactly. Yes.
And when you're talking about the health system, I mean that's a concept in its own right. Are you talking about the totality of a almost like a service that an individual could access if they need some help with their own personal well-being or that of a friend or a relative?
Yeah. So from when I use the system, I guess that is also more than the researcher talking to me. You're right. Usually we focus on specific healthcare activities. So when we talk about public trust, that my main research is around data sharing and data use. So for example, the introduction of national electronic health record systems or data donation for biomedical research. But other examples of, or classic examples, I would say, of public trust research are around vaccine hesitancy, vaccination campaigns, organ donation as well in recent years in many European countries. And those are usually then the activities we are looking at. And we see that that several of those, also, for example, the introduction of national electronic health record system in many European countries, it's on the table for over 20 years now. And here I'm not talking about electronic health records within one hospital, for example, but really like a national system where we can share electronic health records. And one of the bigger reasons or issues which always come up are questions of trustworthiness and public perceptions of trustworthiness and overall trust in the system. And why we can, I think, talk about the system at large is really that we see so-called spillover effects of mistrust from one healthcare activity to another healthcare activity because people associate either those healthcare activities with the same government. And that can even go outside of healthcare. So, for example, if somebody will think, well, the government is not able to regulate data share in the banking sector, and there was more in financial crisis times, right? They might also then think, well, then the same government is not able to regulate data sharing in the healthcare system. So I think the system approach is something which is important to consider. And if we take a too narrow focus on one specific healthcare activity or even one healthcare provider, we might oversee or overlook that there are certain quite impactful other events happening that can also influence and frame the trust building in this one specific healthcare activity. So that's why we, in the research, usually move between specific case studies. And they actually also go absolutely down to the healthcare provider, right? So if we talk about vaccination, but then we also talk about the healthcare system at large because we try to see how the concept is influenced by the individual activity and that setting in the bigger system context.
And do you see different demographic attitudes of trust in the health system? So is a older person more likely to trust differently to a younger person or a wealthier person to a poorer person, or an educated person to a less educated person, and so on. So do you see different approaches to trust based on the demographics of the people?
Yeah, I think it depends. I'm sorry to say that. Depends a bit on the country and also context and the healthcare activity. But yes, usually there is, let alone just the experience with the healthcare system itself. So we, for example, just finished a round of focus group interviews. Those are interviews where we meet several members of the public and interview them at the same time, right? And we talked about their perception of what makes a national electronic health record system trustworthy. And you saw already, just based on their experience, that the younger had even sometimes difficult time understanding, well, why do we need an electronic health record? Well, I'm not really ill, right? I'm not often going to the GP. And if I go, I always go to the same GP. Whereas maybe patients or participants who are have chronic diseases and were patients for a long time in the system, they see more the advantage of health data sharing. And that is just based on personal experiences. And I think that maybe then translates to difference in age groups and also in education. I think education can go in both ways. On the one hand, we see with high levels of education, for example, that people can tend to be more critical, more questioning, but then also they also see the advantage and they're maybe more trusting. But I think it's difficult to generalize. I think it's really because trust itself is also context dependent, right? So as we said in the beginning, it depends really on the context we talk about. I think here we cannot just generalize. That's maybe also why trust building on a system level and a specific is right, because we need to address very different population groups and very, very different contexts.
It was quite interesting. I had a conversation with my son yesterday evening, actually. He's 16, and it's my wife's birthday, so he bought a present for her off a website that has a reputation for stealing data, a new reputation. I always say what the website is. And I said to him, you're aware of this, aren't you? And he said, yeah, absolutely. Weren't you concerned about it? And he went, well, everyone has my data. So it wasn't so much that he didn't trust or didn't know that there was a risk. It was the inevitability of the fact that his data was already out there. And it was an acceptance that bad may come from that. Now, I know that credit card data and debit card data and so on is very different, and personal address and things like that is quite different to medical data. But that kind of almost ambivalent response to one's data, do you see that in a healthcare setting to what is probably emerging in a more general setting?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's one of the very often discussed topics. When we do research, I always see in the healthcare context, people are very critical or were questioning a lot data sharing, let's say, even for national electronic health record system, where I would say, well, the benefits should be quite visible because this is for improvement of primary care preliminary. But then when we talk about the research use, and people get quite critical, so meaning that the data are anonymized and used for secondary use and research. And we see that on the one hand, yes, as you say, people in the private life, they very willingly share their data on the smartphones and apps, and often questioning the wider possibilities of how the data is used. But then when it comes to healthcare, it seems quite to the opposite. Which is interesting because here in Switzerland, for example, the government actually has quite a good reputation, and still people are very protective of their data. I think in the German-speaking countries in Europe in general, privacy and security, data security, are at the forefront of trustworthiness, and so we clearly see the difference. I don't know if those are in the attitudes, but in the daily life, people share data, and in the healthcare context, they at least talk about critically about the data sharing. That said, when you do interviews and talk to people, which chronic diseases or work in the healthcare field, they usually see the immediate benefit of data sharing also for research purposes. So then again, that comes back to experiences and the possibility to see their direct need. And they have a very different, attitude towards data sharing usually.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you would imagine that the logical conclusion here is that someone's attitude to sharing their data in a general setting, whether it be on social media or with, you know, when they're buying something, would bleed into all areas. So is there almost like a barrier when it comes to one's health? Is that what's causing people to adopt a slightly different attitude to it? Or is it just a timing thing, and eventually the logical conclusion here is that everybody will be okay with data sharing in its widest sense?
I think it's a very good question at the end. So for a lot of people, health, their personal health is the most precious thing they have. And they seem to be very protective. But then again, when they are in acute need and in a treatment situation, then they're absolutely willing to share the data because otherwise they might not be treated. I think there's usually a bit of a disconnect in the discourse between what is actually happening and then what are the possibilities people imagine what will be done with the data. Because, as I said before, in interviews with patient groups, you usually have quite a positive attitude towards data sharing. But I think what is missing for the general public often is the communication around those national initiatives. The communications usually fail to have juicy examples, show the immediate benefit, and often remain rather in the abstract. And I think that is also something which is a bit not undermining trustworthiness, but prolongs the way towards trust because often the general communication campaigns around those topic areas are very, they're at least not use those juicy examples or really trigger emotion around it. It's very sterile, very medical often. And I think that is a bigger problem in the trust building at the moment, that policymakers and the government is usually they don't focus so much on the communication in that sense, that they really try to address different patients or different public groups with different language levels, an easy understandable language, juicy examples, etc.
Okay, and fostering public trust in the health system. We talked earlier about how you build individual trust. So building public trust in the health system, how does that happen? You posed that question in your book. How did you go about addressing that question?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is when we go back to the healthcare activities are usually activities which are done or which are executed by a network of actors. Now, and similarly, when you want to build public trust, it's a network activity. It's an action between policymakers, legislation, and frontline staff, and medical staff. That is, I think, really, really important. For a lot of people, trust buildings in the healthcare system, wider healthcare system, really goes via healthcare system representatives. No, they go to their GP, ask the GP about something, they talk to their midwife, they talk to their physician or etc., to the pharmacist. And I think it is very, very important to build a trust-building campaign around all actors. So I think the worst what can happen is, for example, when a politician goes into the media and announces a new healthcare activity, data-sharing activity, and then the patient goes to the GP and asks, hey, can you tell me a bit more about it? And the GP says, I've never heard about it. Okay. So that is, I think, not really helpful. So what is important is that it's a net benefit. So we need all of the three. So the policymakers and politicians, the legislation the frontline staff. And then I would say the critical thing is improvement of communication. So communication, if we don't understand, if we don't know about something, we cannot build trust in it. So we need information. And I think it is important to show immediate or anticipated benefits of those healthcare activities with juicy examples, with easy to understand examples, easy language, so that people can really envision, okay, why should I take part in this activity? Okay, why is this beneficial for me or my children or my relatives? And in the overall construct of trust building, the research shows that trust is built by basically three bigger information sources. One relates, what I would say, to the past, so familiarity, experiences of my family, of my society, let's say, my personal experiences. So past experiences are always quite important and I wouldn't say dominant, but they make a huge part of trust building. So let's say if we had repeated negative experiences with healthcare activities, I think it's quite difficult then if the healthcare system introduces a new activity to build trust, because they first need to overcome and need to address what didn't work in the past, because people reflect on those experiences. And then the middle part is present perceptions. So that means, is the healthcare system capable of doing what it says it would like to do, right? So if we have the feeling, well, it sounds all nice, but maybe it's this, or we question a bit the capabilities, the potential, let's say, of the system or in healthcare activity to really lead to the anticipated benefit, then that's also difficult. So we need past experiences, present perceptions. And the last part, my future anticipation. So clearly we want to know why we should trust. So what will be the anticipated benefit? Why should we get vaccinated? Why should we donate the data? So, and only if those three parts come together, I think we are able to build trust. And here it is very, very important to know the context, to know the society, the public, and what the public anticipations are, what they think, what is important as well. And so that they need some I would say, well, research, but a good understanding of what is going on of the public discourse. And the last two parts are system guarantees, because on the one hand, as I said, trust is built by placed representatives of the healthcare system, but then trust is also built for many by existing guarantees. So that means I trust the healthcare data sharing activity, for example, because I know that there are certain legislations in place, I know that there are certain codes of conduct in place, I know that there is an oversight or accountability mechanism in place. And so there are certain activities, call them activities or measures in place that help to guarantee, let's say, that the activity is trustworthy. And the last part, and that is quite an important one, is the autonomy question. So is it that the government tries to enforce something on the public, which is usually not well taken, or is it that the public has the choice to take part? And that is quite a difficult question at the moment to answer, because from a just theory perspective, we know that autonomy or the choice of the person willing to trust, to give trust, is very important. It's illogical to enforce trust, so we cannot demand trust. It's always the trusting party who assesses the trustworthiness of the to-be-trusted party. And so in this part is really on autonomy. And I think the healthcare system, informed consent process, for example, and giving consent is a crucial part, patient autonomy. But then we see, if we talk about those national campaigns, it is very difficult to implement something with those going via, let's say, opt-in or informed consent processes, because it is often not possible to convince the entire public to take part. So what we see instead, for example, when we introduce national electronic health record systems, then now there's a shift towards so-called opt-out mechanism. That means that by default, all members of the public get, for example, an electronic health record, and if they don't want one, they opt out of the electronic health record system. So that still gives autonomy and still gives the possibility to withdraw. But from a policy and practical point of view, I think this is what we see, what a lot of national activities go on in this direction, at least in the introduction of national electronic health record. So I think in totality, to build public trust, it's really that there needs to be a harmonized net action between policymakers, legislation, and healthcare professionals. We need clear communication with juicy examples that are easy to understand for everyone. The activities need to focus on past experience, present perceptions, and future anticipations. We need to have system guarantees inbuilt in the activities, and we need to offer autonomy. Is it via, let's say, opt-in approaches, consent approaches, or opt-out approaches and withdrawal?
The idea of using opt-out as a mechanism to enable autonomy is very interesting to me. I spent 10 years working in financial services, and I dealt with the remediation of a massive insurance mis-selling problem. And the root of that was it was insurance attached to a loan, and the insurance was to deal with the circumstance. If you can no longer service the loan, it would pay the monthly payments for you. That's what the insurance was for. And there was a period in time where essentially the UK banking industry was allowing an opt-out of the insurance. So it was attaching it to the product as a default, and people are opting out. And then there was also a period when there was an opt-in. And the take-up rate, exactly the same product, the take-up rate if it was an opt-out was 80, 90%. And the take-up rate if it was an opt-in was 20 to 30%. So there's a really big differential between how you frame people in the first place. And actually that difference led to a mis-selling scandal. So it was the forced assignment of the insurance onto the banking product meant that lots and lots of people didn't realize that they had the insurance. When they found out eventually that they did, they realized they'd been missold to because they didn't need it because they had cover elsewhere and, you know, these types of things. Does that analogy work in healthcare in this particular situation? Because, you know, I wonder whether people know that they've actually been opted in.
And that exactly,
pay attention to the communication, for example.
Absolutely. That's exactly one of those examples of the spillover effect, for example, we talked about earlier. Because those examples exist, and that's also why opt-out is quite a difficult topic, let's say. I think also a lot of politicians and policymakers might not like the idea because they fear very similar, or that the public has similar associations. But I think in the end, it goes down to communication. It needs absolutely also an opt-out system. The intention is not that you just bypass them something, you know, just silently introduce something. It needs to go with a proper information campaign. And I would also use the term informed opt-out, let's say, you know, like informed consent. It's just a question of efficiency. And you can also argue it takes a bit burden away from parts of the public because they are enrolled already. They don't need to go to somewhere and need to make the efforts if they agree. So you can also see it more maybe as a service, but absolutely it needs to go in line with proper communication and information. Otherwise it won't work because then people have similar associations, similar to the examples you just said, and those bad examples exist, and that's also why a lot of policymakers and parts of the public are skeptical towards opt-out approaches. But in the focus groups, for example, we just finished last year on the introduction into trustworthiness, also national electronic health record systems. In the German context, we asked exactly the question about what the participants would think about the introduction of opt-out, because in Germany they are also now moving towards an opt-out system, similar in Switzerland, for the introduction of those national electronic health records. And the discussions were very interesting because overall the understanding was it is beneficial, and it's something good because that on the one hand, one argument was, for example, that kind of forces people to think about it because evidently opt-in approaches didn't work. On the other hand, there was also a bit skepticism towards it, very similar to what you just said, and the question also about appropriate information, about maybe misuse of power, overriding people's wills, etc., etc. So I think from an introduction point of view, I think opt-out is the way to go, but only if it's properly communicated, if there's good communication about it, and if the people actually have a good understanding of what is going on, and also that the opt-out process is easy to do. You know, it's, I think a lot of the processes sometimes are quite difficult in the healthcare system for citizen, and those opt-in and opt-out processes, one of the two, they both need to be easy to do, easy to fulfill, and easy to understand. And that already is a problem quite often.
Absolutely. Now, I want to go back to the idea of trust for a specific treatment, and the example of the vaccine for COVID-19, I think, is a really interesting situation. I wonder what the research says about this. So when the vaccine was first announced and released to the public, there was a meaningful body of people that weren't sure whether they could trust the vaccine for themselves, for their children, for their relatives. And it seems like the governments all around the world managed to overcome that concern that a number of people in the public sphere were expressing. And I think the real trigger for this is that there were a number of incentives for them to do it. So, for example, they couldn't travel if they didn't have a vaccine and people wanted to travel. And there are other things that they couldn't do if they didn't have a vaccine. So what did that teach us about the public and their propensity to trust in a situation where there are incentives to follow what the healthcare system is asking them to do, even if they're not entirely sure it's right?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I think that goes really back to the juicy examples and the immediate benefit. I think here I would say with COVID, as you just used the example of travel, there's certain also force into the situation. So it's not enforced, but well, either you are vaccinated or you don't travel. So it's not much of an autonomy and choice question anymore. Yeah, you could also argue theoretically, if you like, that maybe trust is not even the right concept anymore, because trust requires situation of choice. Nevertheless, I think you could really use the examples also to show, well, you know, there was an immediate benefit, let's say, there was a need, there was an incentive, and so it was definitely not abstract. So there was something people could really see. So they get vaccinated, get their certificate, next day they can travel. So it's like a very touchable, visible process. And that is often lacking in other, I would say, let's say, bigger data sharing related healthcare activities, because on the one hand, I think similar to different age groups, while if you are younger, you are usually not going to the healthcare professionals often as maybe when you're older, and then you don't see the immediate need, so it remains a bit more abstract. And I think this is really one of the important parts again, that whenever you do as a healthcare system, if you want to introduce something new, which is for the public, you really need to show how this is has a good effect, which is tangible. Yeah.
And this is a completely random question, but it comes to mind, and you hear this from time to time with people. There's certain things people do that's bad for their health, like smoking. Has there been discussions around using, and we're slightly going off the topic of trust now, by the way, but there might be a parallel of using a trigger like, if you do things that are bad for your health, then your access to the health system is not going to be as open as if you don't do those things, or you may pay more tax, or you may get access to those services in a different way to the way that someone doesn't. So I'm just trying to think about the, I'm trying to draw a parallel with COVID and the vaccines and the lack of trust in the vaccine with other relatable human behaviors that aren't good for themselves, create a burden for the healthcare system. Is there any research around this? We may have gone off topic a bit too far, but
yeah, I'm not, your thoughts. Okay, yeah. I'm not so much familiar with this type of research. Where on the one hand, we have research around nudging, so the other way around, that you try to nudge people into good or more healthy behavior, right? So we also try to incentivize. We also know from insurance companies that they have programs when you sign up with a certain sports gym or do improve that you do sports, you maybe might get a reduction in the premium or you get additional benefits. So there's this trying or this idea that you kind of like influence the behavior. But I think it more goes on towards like positive guiding people towards, it's not like punishing. So if you smoke, you get less. It's more like, okay, try something else. That said, we had in other interviews a while ago, also discussions about how we can use data or data sharing with insurance companies. And there were some participants who clearly said, well, I would be very happy and willing to share my data with the insurance company because a healthcare insurance company, because I want to show that I'm a healthy citizen. So I want to pay less because why should I carry the big shared risk, let's say, right? So I think those ideas would resonate with parts of the public, but it's going more towards this, autonomous, positive attitude.
Yeah. Understood. Right, let's get back on topic. So again, trust in the healthcare system is the kind of main thrust of what we're talking about. Now, artificial intelligence comes in and it's a huge tool that can be adopted by medical practitioners to help them with diagnosis. It's obviously, there's a lot of data that artificial intelligence can now mine to help understand all sorts of different things. Now, I know you've done some recent research about the theory of trust of artificial intelligence in the healthcare system. Can you just explain what you were exploring and what you found and what you concluded from that research, which I thought was really fascinating?
Yeah, thank you. So that goes back to work I did in my previous office at the ETH Zurich. And colleagues, Anna Jobon, Mathieu Jenka, and everybody, you know, they published a well-cited paper in 2019, which was called The Global Landscape of AI Ethics Guidelines. And they reviewed plenty of guidelines, international guidelines that explain what one can do to develop an ethical AI. And I was sitting next to them in the office and I was doing my trust research. And then those ethics guidelines, we saw where there's the term trust emerging quite frequently. Not always, but it's there. And then I looked at the data and said, well, what you see here is really that the guidelines, they explain, understand, conceptualize trust in very different ways, even to the degree that sometimes they contradict each other. So there was a common understanding, likely, that trust is important in one way or the other, but that's about it. So there was no coherent understanding of what trust in AI is. And then Anna and Marcello and I, we wrote a short discussion paper, really, trying to highlight what the problems are. And I think what we saw, so it's, you know, for 3-4 years old, and since then, it's an emerging field now. We see that trust and AI is more and more picking up because the underlying motivation, I guess, is that AI is for a lot of people very difficult to understand. It's an uncertain, has certain uncertainty in it. It's difficult to explain sometimes, also for professionals. And there are certain beliefs around AI, I guess, in the public mainly, probably shaped by science fiction movies and novels, not necessarily what is really happening. But there's certain risk around AI, right? And then I guess trust comes in because trust is a concept that can overcome this uncertainty. So we, for example, trust then the AI user, the doctor, or the company building the AI or licensing the AI, that that is a trustworthy system, and that's how trust comes in. So that makes it possible for us to use AI despite the doubts and uncertainties. And then we looked at the existing concepts, and saw, well, there's really a lot of confusion in the field. It goes in very different directions, and we basically asked four questions. So we said, well, what is the fitting concept, right? So what is really trust in AI? Does it make sense at all? Because I think if you are more conservative in trust theory, you will argue, well, trust is something which is built between individuals. But we just in the last half an hour talked also about trust in the system. So we see the concept kind of expands into systems and technology. But does it really make sense to talk about trust AI? You know, can AI understand that AI is trusted? So that's one more theoretical question. But let's say if we want to use the term trust and it is used in the context of AI, so what is really the concept we talk about, right? What are the contextual factors which frame our understanding of trustworthiness and trust? So meaning like where is AI used in which context? That also makes a huge difference. Probably, I guess we have a lot of AI supported now apps on our mobile phone. That's something entirely different from using AI in the healthcare system. And then the other question, which is also part of a lot of research now, is really like who trusts whom in the AI relationship. Meaning, is the user, so for example, a GP or radiologist, trusting AI? Does it really logically make sense, or is he or she just using it as a means of information to get information, additional information source, let's say, in the process of coming to conclusions about certain treatments, options, etc.? Or is it that maybe the GP trusts the physician trusts the hospital because he or she knows that the hospital has bought the AI based on certain licensing and also certain, maybe also certification processes. And so that's really something which is still a bit fuzzy, I would say. Also the entire discussion about patient trust in the AI, it's really the patient that trusts an AI which is used by a doctor, I would argue probably not. So it's more that the patient trusts the GP, and the GP might disclose or not disclose that AI is part of the decision process. But it's a highly, highly complex system. So those questions are, I think, important to answer, because if we don't know who's trusting whom and what context, it's difficult to address the concept and do something about trust building if you want to do something. The last part I think we try to focus on or raise the question is what is empirically proven? Okay, so what really works in trust building? So I guess in the overall context of AI and trust, there are still a lot of open questions. And I think also to a certain degree there's a bit of hype around it. But I think you can very well argue from a theoretical point of view that it makes sense to question or think about trust in the context, because as I said earlier, trust is a concept that can overcome this high complexity of AI system, the high uncertainty, and makes it basically useful for us in the AI system. Yeah.
It's interesting. I was talking to another researcher some time ago about AI, and it feels like there's a creeping acceptance. So it goes from being something that's very cool to something that's a tool, to something you just accept what it says. And as these tools get more capable, it may be that we almost unconsciously end up trusting these systems in a way that, and I'm talking about the general public, not necessarily the healthcare system, which would be a part of the system that I'm talking about, such that we almost default into trust as a logical outcome. I'll give you an example that it's not healthcare related, but it is AI related. You know, a lot of cars now, my car, it brakes automatically. I can set it on a speed and the car in front of me slows down, my car slows down. And actually, we were on a journey recently with my wife and my kids, and I was using it. And my wife asked me very simply, how do you know that the car's going to stop? I was like, well, it does. So therefore, it will continue to do so. May not one day, that would be terrible. And I'd make sure I'm alert to that. You can see how this kind of creeping trust of the system is coming in. Do you not see that in healthcare and the applications of AI in healthcare, particularly when it comes to diagnosis and things like that?
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, absolutely. I think also why the example you just said is actually also helpful, I think, for the overall acceptance of AI. So when we see that AI systems are reliable, they work in our daily living environment, not in healthcare, no, just in our daily life, then we have a lot of positive experiences. And that also goes then more towards the positive spillover effects, let's say, where we see, okay, yeah, it works really around, works reliably around us in the car context as well. So why shouldn't it work in healthcare? And I think that then goes into the phase where I would say maybe then also trust goes into the background, because nobody talks about trust anymore, you know, it just works. And I think usually issues of trust come up, and we talk about trust when we are suspicious or question something or find something untrustworthy. But if everything is fine, everything works, I think people don't talk about trust anymore. It's just there, it works, it's fine. That's how it should be as well, I would argue. So eventually also talk about all the other healthcare system activities. I think if trust building works, if they are accepted, if people take part, I think the issues of trust are not discussed anymore. That's the normal state. Normally, I think it works fine, all is good.
That'd be a great place to end up. So Dr. Killer, this has been a really interesting conversation about an important topic that I don't think is discussed that widely actually amongst the general public. So I'm really appreciative that you've taken the time to share your research with me today. Do you have any kind of final thoughts or topics that you think we should cover just to finish off?
Well, I think we talked about a lot of stuff I'm working on, and I really found it a very nice last conversation. Thank you. And I think that's a maybe takeaway or something. I think it's important that I would say policymakers and those in charge of the healthcare system understand that public trust is fundamental for the success of the healthcare system. And I'm arguing in the direction now that we should maybe consider that public trust and trust should be performance outcomes targets of healthcare activities. So to introduce them similar to KPIs, key performance indicators, that we set really trust as an outcome target for healthcare activities. So it could maybe then really as an integral part of the system help for trust building.
Wonderful. Dr. Killer, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow it on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.